So I want to start by making some, closing off some loose ends. One of the issues that came up in the tutorial that was pointed out by Elliot is that the conditions that I said we should impose on the matrix X do not really imply that the matrix is used. So X went to X prime U X U dagger. So the fact that, you know, the determinant of this has to be preserved and it has to be traceless and Hermitian doesn't mean that U is in SU2, but that U is in U2. And the point here is that if you look at the U1 factor of U2, it actually has trivial action on X. The part of U2 that has non-trivial action on X is the SE2. Therefore, SE2 is the one, is the group that is relevant for the homomorphism that we're building. The second problem, I have rewritten it. And so those of you who attempted it, you can have a look. And then if you want to chat about it outside class, I'm happy to do that. The other thing I didn't have time to define yesterday is what an abelian invariant subalgebra is. So it's a subalgebra that commutes with everything, every in the Lie algebra. If you define, after defining what an abelian invariant subalgebra is, one can define a semi-simple Lie group or Lie algebra. So it's a Lie algebra which doesn't have an abelian invariant subalgebra. It is not hard to see, show that an example of a semi-simple Lie group, Lie algebra, is the Lie algebra of SO4, because it actually breaks up into two Lie algebras, two different SU2s. Okay, so today I wanted to touch upon a smattering of topics. Time is running out. I would hope to get to SU3, the representation theory of SU3. So I will not be probably as thorough as I would like to be. So, some say useful geometric concepts you can define a natural metric called the Killing metric. This guy is killing it. On a Lie group, and to define it, we first define what a left invariant one form is. So this is a left invariant one form. So this is a and it derives its name from the fact that if you replace G by G times H times G, where H is in the Lie group G, but constant, meaning that the derivative operator, leaves it, doesn't act on it, then this object is invariant under this transformation. Now, this thing is an element of the, it's a one form, so it's a cotangent space. So M is the manifold of the Lie group. It's also an element of the Lie algebra. We can similarly define a right invariant form, and that's basically DGG inverse. This is the right invariant one form. Then to define the killing metric, we consider this bi-invariant, which means that it's both left and right invariant object, which is trace of G inverse DG, G inverse DG. Obviously, by its definition, it is left invariant, but because the trace is cyclic, you can also see that it can be written in this form, so it's also right invariant. Now, using the fact that this is a form as well as a Lie algebra valued object, we can expand this object. So there will be some. So suppose phi are the coordinates on my manifold. So because it's a one form, there will be something like a one form the basis, and there would be the summed over those indices. It's also a Lie algebra valued object, so there would be an A, and that would be contracted with the generators A, and this thing should be a function of the coordinate. So now if I plug this into there and use the fact that G is some compact compact Lie group, so that I can normalize the trace of TA TB to be some constant time delta AB.
Can you explain T and phi again?
Oh yeah, sure. So phi are the coordinates on M, which is the the manifold. Well, sometimes I call it M, and sometimes I've called it G as well, right? The manifold of the Lie group. Sorry, of the Lie group G. And TA are the generators in the defining representation. In this case. So now if I plug this formula in there, I basically get and there's some constant, and there's a delta AB times d of phi mu, d d of phi nu. And this looks like a line element if I identify this thing to be a metric. So this is essentially what I've constructed, is a line element on the Lie group. Yeah?
Sorry, just these G's over here, are they group elements?
Yeah.
And the H is also a group element, and when you say it's constant, are you saying that this is a left invariant under any transformation by any H in the group?
Right, yeah.
And for a right invariant, would you be multiplying by H on the right?
Yes. So right invariant means that G, right, so.
So and DG is the element of the cotangent bundle?
Yeah.
And then is G inverse an element of the Lie algebra?
Lie group, okay. So let me break this down, okay? Yeah. So suppose, so G is, okay, G is an element of the Lie group G, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if I have a compact Lie group, I can always use the exponential map and write it as e to the power I something, right? And this is belongs to the Lie algebra, right? So when I take the exterior derivative of, with respect to this guy, what I see is I basically, so let's call this dot t, right? Then I would get g times I t dot this thing, right? I'm bringing down this object down, right, from the exponential. Okay. And right, so I can write this on this side, and right. So now G inverse will be given by So now if I multiply this guy goes away, and what I'm left with is T dot. Right, so this is the statement that this is in the cotangent bundle, which is given by this guy.
Okay.
And this is the Lie algebra, which is given by this guy. Okay.
So is that when you write dot there, is that, like, I mean, so when you write them, yeah. So the zetas are just...
They're just the coordinates, right? Okay, I should call them phi, right? Because to be consistent, sorry. Let me call okay, I mean, I think
what is G?
Sorry?
What is G?
G is an element of your group. It's a finite element.
Maybe it's group value, but it has to be a field over something for you to take that.
What do you mean field over something? Hang on. I think that okay.
So it's G, you have phi.
So can you repeat that?
It's G of phi, so because you're driving.
Right, so I'm saying that, okay, so what I'm saying is that my G is some group manifold. G is some group, and on that group I have some coordinates, right? So sorry, yeah. So the phis are, okay. I think there is some notation. I mean, I just introduced some bunch of notation here, but what I mean is that zeta are the parameters which parameterize your group element.
Your field of group elements.
field, I don't know what you mean by field of group element, but you know.
To each value of the coordinates, you associate.
Right, it's a coordinate map on some group element, and you know phi and the zetas represent the coordinate. So if I set all these parameters to zero, I get to the identity element. Right.
So why is phi wrong? Why cannot phi be there?
Sorry?
Why cannot phi be there?
Why cannot phi be there? Yeah, that's a good question because So in essence, okay, what I'm doing is I'm introducing what. So suppose you have some manifold, and you take some point, and you take a tangent space at that point. And you have on the tangent space, you know, some tangent vectors, and those tangent vectors say are something like So if I kind of look at this part, so I look at EA mu of phi, D of phi mu, these are the basis vectors in the coordinate basis, which I'm calling phi. This is the basis one forms in the coordinate. But this thing together is actually giving me some field of one form, say, I don't know, call it eta of A. So these are one forms. And so now the question is, how is that related to these parameters psi zeta, right?
Is E a tensor that's defined by the group element G?
Sorry?
Is E defined by the group element G?
So the E is. So okay, what the E does is that it gives you a basis of one forms. It's basically an object which translates between a basis of one form. So these one forms, what they do is that, suppose this is the cotangent space, and these one forms form the basis of the cotangent space. And as I you know, as I move around on my manifold, you know, I have different values of phi. And what these E's do is that it tells me how to translate between the coordinate basis, which is one form, which is d phi of mu, and the, you know, the and the non-coordinate basis, which is the these eta a's. So in Cartan's language, this is basically a kind of a moving frame, if you like. So it's not obvious. So let me come back to what's the relationship between phi and the parameter zeta. It's kind of I'm not able to make that connection right now, but let me come back to that point.
What you're trying to do is build a geopine that's canonical to the group.
Right.
And get the
matrix. Yes.
Build a geopine, tetrad.
Yeah, moving frame, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, so if you think of phi as being the coordinates on your map group, and then these are just some kind of, you know, coefficients, right? You can think of this as being coefficients. Now, hang on just one second. So I guess you can make the connection between these zetas and this by taking the trace of this object, right? So now this is probably the answer to your question, is that if I now say, okay, I'm taking T of A and saying D of DG inverse, and I take the trace of this thing, then what I would get is that I'll get a delta from here, you know, and so I will get some lambda times E of mu of A of phi, and then I would get D of phi mu. And if I were to do the same thing over here, I would get up to some factors of I. I will get I times d of zeta a. So so basically this is going to be the relationship from between you know, between phi and the zetas, right? Yeah.
So one last question. There's actually two questions. I'm kind of confused about what object G inverse DG is.
Okay.
So TA is an element in the tangent space, and the D zeta A is in the cotangent space, right?
Right, right. Well,
phi, say, is in the cotangent space.
Yeah, I mean, so, right. So you can think of, yeah, you're right. So you can think of this as, so for matrix Lie groups, you can have an identification between the tangent space and the Lie algebra element. So here I'm thinking of the TAs more as being residing in the Lie algebra.
Okay.
And this as residing in the cotangent space.
Okay. Regardless, I don't understand what you mean by writing, sorry, this is just my lack of understanding.
No, it's fine, yeah.
But I don't understand what you mean by writing the tensor product there. Like, I mean, if you, like a covector times a vector should just give a scalar, right?
I'm not really taking the inner product between these two guys.
So what kind of, like, how should I understand this object?
you have a point, but the best way to think about it is that, you know, this is some matrix, right? So this is a matrix valued thing. And this is, you know, this is a one form, which is, you know, the usual way of. So I mean, I am kind of not, at this point, I am thinking of this as it's just a Lie algebra, but not as the dual, space to the cotangent space.
I'm sorry, my other question, it's a small question.
That's fine.
On the top half of this board here, you use D, G, DG, so should one of those be inverse?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so, yeah. All right. Thank you for those questions. So so this thing is called the killing metric. And if you are given a metric, you can always define a torsion-free connection called the Levi-Civita connection. So if I have G mu nu will give rise to some torsion free. This is the torsion free connection. This is called the Levi-Civita connection. It's also called the Christoffel symbol. This is not a tensor object, but the important thing here is that this is actually symmetric in these indices. Someone asked me if the Christoffel symbols were related to the structure constant. The structure constants give you antisymmetric. It's antisymmetric, so they are not directly related. However, there are other connections. So there are other connections. On the manifold on G that you can define, and those connections are not torsion free. And the structure constants I do contribute to them. but we won't go there. It just involves too much formalism. So I wanted to close off the part about geometry by talking about the action of groups on manifolds. So I wanted to talk about group actions. And so what is a group action? So let G be a Lie group and M is some manifold the action of G on M is a map that goes from G times M to M such that the group action of the identity element on some point P, on point P is P for all points of the manifold, and that the group multiplication law is implemented in this way, that if you apply G2, G1 on P is the same thing as applying G1 first and then applying G2 on the result of that. So group actions can have different kind, there can be different kind of group actions. So it can be transitive. So if for any P1 and P2 in M, you know, there exists an element G in my group such that we can reach P2 by applying that element on P1, then the group action is called transitive. A group action is free if for G, which is not equal to E, there is no fixed point of the action. What we mean is that if for P in for M, the action of the of some element on P is leaves it invariant, then that means that it must be the identity element. If that is the case, then we say that the action is free. And we will see a counterexample to that very soon. Okay, let's give a counterexample to transitive. So the action of the rotation group on R3 is not transitive, because if you take two vectors, x and x prime, such that their length is not equal. So these are, you know, where x and x prime are position vectors in R3, then if they don't have the same length, you know, x prime and x prime cannot be connected via a rotation. So that's a very almost a trivial example of how transitivity can fail. On the other hand, you know, the action of SO3 on S2 is transitive. So by applying SO3, we can get from any point on S2 to any other point on S2. However, we know that this action is not going to be free, because we know that, for example, rotation around the z-axis will leave the north pole and the south pole, you know, invariant, right? So there are some group actions which will leave some of the points invariant. So it's not a free action, and we'll come back to that. So let's look at the definition of a little group. Also known as the stabilizer. So let G be a Lie group that acts on M so the little group of the point P in M is defined by is defined to be the subgroup which leaves P invariant, I guess. But what I mean is that H of P, this is the little group, of P. This consists of all the elements in G such that the action of those elements on the point P has no effect on it. So in other words, P is a fixed point of the action of H. Okay, the example, of course, is, as I mentioned, SO2, which is a subgroup of SO3. So SO2, say, the SO2 that, say, that leaves the North Pole, invariant is the little group. Of the North Pole. Of course, there are more than one SO3s, inside, SO2 is inside SO3, so you have to specify which SO2 is the little group depends on which point you're choosing. So, so we now come back to an idea that we introduced before, which is a coset. And now I'm going to introduce the idea of a coset manifold. So suppose H is some subgroup of G, which is, you know, which is a proper subgroup. And now consider the set, which I will denote by G by H, and it consists of all the right cosets. So this G of H consists, the elements are the different cosets, or the different cosets. So they are not group elements. They're the elements themselves are themselves sets. So
now, isn't this definition incorrect?
Sorry?
Isn't this definition incorrect?
Right.
Shouldn't it be G, small g element that isn't part of H times the whole group H?
You're right. What I'm saying is that, yeah. So if I, this is just a notation. If I said this is the coset for the element H, this is just notation. Of course, when I'm, you know, as you say, you know, when I'm constructing the coset, the G's I have to consider are in the complement of H, you're right. I'm just saying this is kind of a, you know, shorthand notation that.
But I don't understand, because we define the coset for the subgroup, not for the element of the subgroup. So you're saying for the H that is part of the subgroup H, but the coset is something that's defined for the whole of H, so not for just one element of H.
Shouldn't it be the other way around?
It's like the other way
small
around.
G, big
sorry?
H.
Small g, big H.
Yeah.
Small.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah. You're right. So, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I see. Sorry. It should be like this, right?
Yeah.
And
G is in the comp.
Is in G minus H, right? Yeah. Okay. All right, cool. So,
excuse me?
Yeah?
I think that G is in G, not G minus H.
Yes.
What I mean is that G is in the complement of H, right?
You need one element for H for the identity.
Because
else you have no neutral elements. So.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
What's the definition? You have many group elements with the same coset, but that doesn't matter for the set to be defined.
Right. Okay. So we say that so if G1, okay, so these are the cosets, and this we call it the coset space. So if G1 is in the same coset, we say that G1 is equivalent to G2. So this is an equivalence class. Now, if in our original manifold, G1 was near by near G2. So they were, you know, we can say that the but say G1 is not, they are not in the same coset. Then we can say that the cosets corresponding to these group elements are also nearby, and therefore extend, you know, the structure of manifold onto the coset space. So in other words, you know, we can think of the coset space as some kind of a manifold. So why is this useful? And the next example should illustrate that. So suppose we take our friend SO3 acting on S2 and say EZ is the position vector pointing to the North Pole. Now, if say if G1 and G2 are in the same coset, then if I apply G1 on this vector, I get to a point which is the same point I would have gotten to if I applied G2. So starting from the North Pole, we can reach any other point, say, so by applying a representative of a coset such that each coset corresponds to a unique point on S2. So in other words, the coset, the elements of the coset space are in one-to-one correspondence with the points on S2. So if you had, because the way that the little group is defined, okay, so sorry, I didn't say which coset I'm talking about. I'm talking about the coset which is SO3 over SO2. So because of this fact, we can say that I'm going to just, because this is blocks your view, so I'm just going to write the last part here, is that because every, because any element in a given coset, if I act on those elements, act by those elements on the on the vectors pointing to the North Pole, it takes me to the same point on the two-sphere. If I take elements from another coset and apply on the North Pole, I will not get to that point, I will get to a different point. Because if I got to the same point, then they would, those two points would actually belong to the same coset. So this tells us that we can think of S2 as the coset space. And this has important application both in geometry and quantum field theory. So when you do spontaneous symmetry breaking and stuff like that, where you know your some bigger group breaks down to some smaller groups, you will see this sort of structure crop up. So that's why I wanted to cover that. Okay, in the remaining half an hour, I want to shift gear and do the finite dimensional representations of SU2, like. I believe that almost all of you have seen it, right? So is there someone who hasn't? In the ladder operators, the final, and those kind of stuff? So I mean, I'm asking, should I skip it? Somebody said no, so I won't skip it. It's good to see that. I mean, it's such a nice thing. It's good to see it twice, right? Okay, any questions from the coset space and things like that? All right. So that brings us into a discussion about the geometry of groups. Okay, so finite dimensional representations of SU2. So when you're talking about SU2 Lie algebra, it is very hard to write T's. It's like some sort of deep conditioning. I want to write T, but somehow it becomes a J. I don't know how. So maybe that's because I'm a physicist. So to make the finite dimensional representation of SU2s, the first thing we do is that we define what are called ladder operators. And these ladder operators are not Hermitian. So if I take the Hermitian conjugate of J plus, I get J minus, and vice versa. In terms of the ladder operators, the Lie algebra of SU2 or SU3 becomes a part that looks like this, and a part that is the commutator of J plus J minus is 2 of J3. Okay. So the rank of the Lie algebra of SU2 is 1. So we choose the Cartan subalgebra to be just the J3 element. So we label states, well, label vector that it will act on by the eigenvalue, which also in physics is usually denoted by M. The comment is that M is not necessarily a quantum state. It's a vector on which the Lie algebra of SU2 acts. And the other thing to notice is that we are not assuming that m is not, not assuming that this is an integer. Okay, so that'll arise naturally. So how do we go forward from here? Well, let's, so if we start with the state M, labeled by M, we can ask what happens to the state if I apply on it the J plus operator. So to see this, I apply J3 on it, and then I use this commutation relationship, and then we get J plus J3 acting on M plus J plus of M. So this is J plus J3 acting on the state M gives me M, and this remains the same. So I can write this as M plus 1 J3 of M. So this means that J plus increases the J3 eigenvalue by 1. And similarly, J3 acting on J minus of M gives me M minus 1 J minus of M, because of this guy with the minus sign over there. So we see that a picture emerges, and the picture is that the state space, or the vector space, is one dimension, is so it can be seen as a ladder. It's not one dimensional, sorry, that's a lie. So there is some state M, and there's some state M plus 1. There's another state M plus 2. But there's a state M minus 1, state M minus 2, and it goes on, not indefinitely, because we are looking for finite dimensional representations. And this is like a ladder, and the J plus help you climb the ladder, and the J minus help you go, they take you down the ladder by one step. So that's why they're called the ladder operators. Now, we can assume that these states are normalized, and or even like they're, I don't think I'm going to use the orthogonality, but they can also, they're orthonormal. However, there is no guarantee that when you apply J plus, you get M plus 1 without a normal, without an overall constant. So what is that overall constant? And that is going to play a crucial role in the whole analysis. Carry so many papers. So we say, okay, when J plus acts on M, it takes us to M plus one, but up to some constant, which we say Cm plus one. And we're going to determine that. So similarly, you know, J minus, when it acts on M, takes us to M minus one, up to some constant M minus one. So, you know, Cm and Dm to be determined. So consider this object. Where I know. So this is just a number, and the M plus one is normalized, so this becomes that. And similarly, if I now consider J minus on M plus one, then according to our definition of D, the right-hand side should give me D of M times M. Now if I, right, so if I take the conjugate of this, we get M plus one, J plus, and then I get DM star, the bra of M, and now I take the inner product of this equation with the ket of M, and this is one, and we see that the left-hand side of this equation is the same as the left-hand side of this equation. So we conclude that Cm plus one is Dm star, okay? So we can rewrite this one, this equation, J minus acting on M, as C star of M times M minus one. Now suppose that M equals to J is the highest possible eigenvalue of J3. So that means that if I apply J plus onto that state, I should get zero. So now, starting with the commutation relation of J plus and J minus, and applying J, you know, sandwiching it between J, I get, remember that J plus acting on J gives me zero, so the first term becomes zero. The second term gives me 2J, JJ, right? But this is J minus acting on this gives me right, so yeah. So we get over here CJ star Cj times j minus 1, j minus 1 is equal to 2j, jj. These guys are 1, so I get Cj mod squared is 2j. Okay, so this is the so we get one of the constants. But for generic values of m, so for generic M, if you now sandwich that equation between generic M we get a recursion relationship between the C's and this recursion relationship along with the value of Cj allows us to solve for the CMs. And how do we do that? So we know what CJ is, so we say, okay, we can use this recursion relationship to say, find out what CJ minus 1 squared is, and that's going to be, CJ squared plus 2M, but M now is J minus 1. Right, so this thing is, if you put in the value of Cj, it becomes 2j minus 1. Let me not skip steps here. This is 2 of j. This is 2j minus 1. So, yeah. So we get 2j minus 1. So similarly, Cj minus 2 squared. I'm looking for a pattern here. That's what M is, j minus 2. And if I now put in the value from before, I get 2 times 3j minus 1 minus 2. Now, you can ask, what is C of j minus s squared? Note that s is a positive integer. So if you carry this on, you find that it's going to be 2 s plus 1 times j minus 1 minus 2 minus dot dot minus s. And there's a sum here. And if you do the sum, you get which if you simplify at s plus 1, 2j minus s. this implies that we have C J minus S. We can choose this to be S plus 1, 2J minus S. Now, as we apply our ladder operator, in this case, if I apply, keep on applying J minus, so I get down, at some point, we want the ladder to terminate because we are looking at finite dimensional representation. But the only way it can terminate is one of these constants going to zero. So at some point, we say, you know, this will be equal to that. That is the only way this thing can go to zero. So this means that the value of J, the highest eigenvalue of M, is S by 2. So it can be either an integer or a half integer, right? Positive integer or positive half integer. The highest value of M. So so J is a positive integer or a half integer. So this means that M is also an integer or half integer. M doesn't have to be positive, but J has to be. Okay. So now if I write the merge, let me come back to the general formula. Man, this is a danger. Like somebody's fingers can, like if you have like big fingers, suppose it breaks. Anyway. There should be a label here, like do not use this when you are inebriated or, you know. Okay, so coming back, so we wrote this for you know, we found this. Now it's time to replace J minus S by M. So if I do that, then I rewrite this equation where this had C of M plus 1, then J minus M and J plus M plus 1, M plus 1, okay? And similarly, if you have J minus of M, it should give us J plus of M, J minus of M plus 1, M minus 1, right? So this thing is, Cm plus 1, and this thing is Cm star, right? And so this so great. So from the coefficient, we see that, you know, when you go up and you apply, when you apply J plus, enough number of times you get when you get m is equals to j, right. So yeah. So when you get to say m equals to say j plus one, there is no more state. So the highest state is, we'll have the label j here, right? And from this you can see that the state that you can get the lowest value of m is going to be minus j. So in total, you're going to have 2j plus 1 states. Well, let's say like steps. Steps in the ladder, right? So that is going to determine the dimensionality of your representation. So if I pictorially, I come from j to j minus 1 by applying j minus, and then I go to j minus 2 by applying j minus again, and then until I come to minus j plus 1, and then if I apply j minus again, I get to minus j, right? And if you apply j minus again, you get to 0. And if you want to go the other way, you have j plus. Sorry, I'm belaboring the point, but. And if I go beyond this, I get 0 again. All right. So I haven't really told you what j is. We only know that j is either an integer or half integer. As you know, that j is the eigenvalue of the j squared operator. So the j squared operator acting on m will give you j times j plus 1 times m for any m. And this is a Casimir invariant that labels the whole representation. So now I want to give you some exercises about working out some of the representations. So, two small exercises. So if I now give you a value of j and ask you, hey, Fati, can you go and work out the matrices of that representation? Okay. So I want you guys to work this out, right? Because this is where the rubber hits the road. Like, you should be able to do that, right? So yeah, basically, you know, so I will give you some, so suppose I want you to find the matrices for the j equals to 2 representation. Okay, So what are the basis vectors? These are minus 2, minus, this is the ladder, right? And then you can find out, you know, what the J3 is. You can find out what J plus is, J minus is, just by, you know, by using this and the, you know, you kind of now know, you know, the how, what, you know, what you get when you apply with the J plus and J minus or J3. So, you know, So, you know, I don't want you to do this by hand, do it by Mathematica, but, you know, plus, you know, do it. So, so we started a little bit late, 10 minutes later, so I'll go on for another 10 minutes. Sorry, no break today. It's very useful. So this is like how to build irreducible representation, right? From scratch. That's what you just learned. But suppose I give you two representations and I say, oh, they represent some different quantum mechanical system and they somehow interact. They have an interaction Hamiltonian. And they form some kind of a bound state. Or they're interacting, we're looking at them from far away. And I want you to tell me what are the possible, you know, what are the possible values of what representation should I expect if I do an experiment, right? And this is known as the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, you know, method series in quantum mechanics. I will not go there, don't worry. You have page due. But we will do, you know, we will generalize that idea, you know, by introducing what are known as what I'm going to call SU2 tensors. So today I will introduce SU2 tensors and some young tableau, which is really another way of dealing with these tensors. So the question, the kind of question we want to ask is that you have a spin half representation, you tensor with some spin half, another two electrons, say. We know that we get a spin one plus a singlet, right? A spin zero. So in group theory language, we write this as two times two as three plus one. So nobody's going to tell you what notation they're using. You'll just have to guess from the context. So the two here refers to the fact that this is a two-dimensional representation, the spin half, this as well. And three represent that the spin one representation is three-dimensional. So formally, what is a 2 of SU2? A 2 of SU2 is some two-dimensional spinner or vector. So this is living in some two-dimensional complex space. Now, notice that if you have a Lie algebra, so for our case, let's consider. So I'm writing it in a basis where these are Hermitian guys and these are real. If I now consider the complex conjugate of that Lie algebra and times minus, so and I define that to be, say, TA tilde, you can verify that the complex conjugate, they satisfy the same Lie algebra. So this is the, so the, these guys form the, like the, a conjugate representation. Let's call this conjugate. F- For SU2, however, for SU2, the fundamental and the conjugate representation, so this is also known as the anti-fundamental. I really like this name because I really don't like fundamentalists. So I am in that representation. However, there's bad news. It turns out for SU2, the fundamental representation is related to the anti-fundamental representation through a similarity transformation. And you can verify where C is I times sigma 2, where sigma is a Pauli matrix. So for SU2, so the vector space, so if there was a, the vector space that the anti-fundamental acts on, we refer it by psi complex conjugated. And for SU2, the notation we use is 2 star. So for SU2, 2 is equal to 2 star. For 2 is isomorphic or whatever. However, for SUN, for n greater than 3, the fundamental representation, which would be n-dimensional, which I call n, is not equal to the anti-fundamental. So now we'll just pretend, unless we have to do some counting where it's important, we'll pretend that 2 and 2 stars are different for the analysis of tensors. But what's important is that the t's act on some vector space psi a, and t tilde act on some other vector space t star of a, spanned by t star of a. For SU2, these are the same vector spaces. Okay. So, say this is an example of a fundamental. So this is 2. And this is under an SU2 transformation. So under SU2, this guy goes like U of A, B acting on B, like this, right? Now, I'm going to introduce some, so you can call it as a vector, right? It's a particular kind of tensor. It's the most basic vector that we can have, or the basic tensor we can have, we transform under SU2. Now we are going to look at some other tensors which are useful, which are known as invariant tensors. And number one, the Levi-Civita symbols like this. So under SU2, this thing is going to transform as So this gives me a rank 2 tensor. But you see that the definition of a determinant tells me that this is the determinant of U times epsilon AB. But we know that the determinant of U for SU2 is 1, so this is EAB. So we see that this tensor object under an SU2 transformation doesn't change. It remains itself. Now, as I said, I'm going to pretend that the 2 star is a different representation. So the notation that one uses is that the 2 star we raise the index for that guy. And under a SU2 transformation, I'm not deriving all these little things because there's a lot of notation because it'll take too much time. But look into Jones. Jones really, I think Jones does it, and also Z does it. So under SU2 transformation, this thing goes like U dagger of A tilde A prime A psi of A prime. And this object, because it has indices upstairs, should transform with the U dagger matrix. Again, by the same logic, the determinant of U dagger is also 1. So we get AB. So it doesn't matter whether the AB is downstairs or upstairs. They're both invariant. And lastly, suppose I give you 2 representations. This is a fundamental, and this is, say, an anti-fundamental. And I say, OK, can you make a singlet out of them? You know, what would you do is that you should contract these 2 things, right? And you can show that if you contract these 2 indices, you get a representation of SU2 which is trivial. So contracting a downstairs index with an upstairs index is done by another tensor. And this tensor should transform like U, say, BB prime, U dagger AA prime delta of A prime B prime. But these are just the inverse of each other. And so it's like if I now use this delta and sum over A prime, I get U of B, B prime, U dagger of A, B prime. So this is just matrix multiplication, which gives me U dagger is U inverse. So I get A of B. So we see that this object is also an invariant tensor of SU2. So these are the invariant tensors of SU2, which will help us build representations. I'm out of time, so I will stop there.
One more thing, Peter. Xi A is from 2 star in there, or I got lost in that view.
Chi A?
Yeah, Chi.
Oh, yeah, sure, great. So, yeah. So it could be a different, I'm using a different symbol, but it could be a different 2.
Okay.
And Psi B is 2 star. Okay. Of course, I mean, we know that for SU2, they're the same. Because you know, you can rotate one to the other by using the similarity transformation. But for SU3, they won't be the same. So that's why I'm distinguishing them.